Hello, hello! Welcome to How to Be a Changemaker. I am so excited to have you here. If you are an organizational leader and have a deep desire to, one, motivate yourself better and to lead yourself with deeper courage, confidence, and conviction, two, empower your employees to be their best, and three, innovate and create a work culture that allows everybody to thrive, you are in the right place. My name is Samantha Clark. I am your host. I'm a happiness consultant and resident change maker here, and I cannot wait to share with you all the gems and amazing goodness in this episode. Take a seat, get ready to enjoy, and tuck in. Hello, hello. I am so excited today to be talking to Angela Duckworth. Hello, Angela. How are you?
Hi, Samantha. I'm happy to be talking to you.
Good, good. How has your year started?
I will say that I had COVID at the end of the winter holiday, and I'm very happy not to have COVID right now, I guess. It's been more than 10 days. But anyway, yes, I'm happy to have a fresh start.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're in much better health now. When you think about yourself, how would you, I've got two questions that I normally ask my guests as we start interviews, and thinking about where we are at this time of the year, what would you say are three words that you would use to describe how you show up in the world?
We'll give you the aspirational ones, right? How about the three words to describe how I'd like to show up in the world? I really would like to show up as a giver.
Okay.
I would like to show up as a learner, and I would like to show up as a doer. Mm. So if I can give, if I could learn, and if I could do things, I think that's how I would like to spend my life.
Mm. So you've said aspirational. Where do you feel you might be falling short in any of these areas? Or do you feel like you're achieving in the way that you want to?
I, you know, give myself an A-. Like I feel like I've been pretty earnest about all three of these, you know, dimensions of my character. But I also feel like, you know, I could do, you know, better. I think with being a giver, which is the first thing that came to mind in particular, you know, my mother is the most generous person I have ever met. Generous, arguably to a fault, but I have, you know, as you know, we all get older, you know, my mom's close to 87. I'm, you know, going to turn 52, you know, my children are grown and they're out of the house. I mean, more and more you think like, wow, you know, the game doesn't run forever. It's not an infinite game. It's a game that has an end and you're not sure when yours is going to be. How do you want to play this game? And I think I could be more generous. I think, you know, there's sort of doing what you're asked to do. And maybe I do a pretty good job of that. But just to give a specific example, you know, there are things that I haven't been asked to do. Like, when's the last time I took time out of my day, sat down at my computer and recommended or nominated somebody for a prize or an award without their asking, without anyone asking, but because I thought they deserved it? I don't know that I've ever done that. Other people do that. I haven't. I'd like to do that in 2022.
Nice. So would you say that that might be your word for the year, thinking about giving in all of its different forms? Or have you chosen a resolution? Do you do that?
I hadn't chosen a word of the year, but maybe I should. I'd want to give it some thought, but you know, giving is definitely, I think, in the direction. I at the end of last year had this spontaneous, you know, like it just came out of my mouth and I don't know why. And it's like, I won't be jealous anymore. Mm. Actually, after saying that, I'm like, what the hell was that? Like, why did I say that? Like, who am I jealous of? Like, I didn't know that I was jealous, but those are the words that left my lips. So nobody else said them. I did. So I'm not sure whether it's, you know, being more generous generally, or also like, you know, not coveting what other people have, but there is absolutely something about being more generous. Like, there are these people in my life, and I won't even say, you know, they're my they're my close friends. Like, I have met people, even as professional acquaintances. There's this one who like leaps to mind. His name is Ron Berger, and he's an educator in Maine, and he has spent his whole life, you know, working with teenagers. And he's the sort of person where when you go and talk to them, they have this tremendous generosity of spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, you come and you're fretting about some question or problems, and they're such givers. Like, it's just like, you know, if I could be a little more like that, you know, that to me would be like the most important thing that I could do. You know, not be necessarily smarter, not be more successful, not be more famous, you know, not even more accomplished, but like, you know, more like Ron Berger. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's to me, that would be like the direction to take my life.
Do you think that that's something that happens when you reach a pivotal point in your life where that is the thing that we need to start doing? As you said, there is a lot of success. You've had, you know, great presence and authority in the space that you're in. And now it feels like the time to refuel others. Or is this something that you think, you know, Ron was naturally born to do this, and that's just fueled how he's developed his career?
Well, I know Ron would never take credit for being born this way. Of course, when I met him, he was already very Yoda-like. But I do think there is like a developmental progression toward otherness. You know, I'm not the first psychologist to think about it this way. You know, there are these like stage theories of life development, and there's this view that's attributed to this great psychologist, Eric Erickson, I think is his name. He wasn't like the kind of psychologist that I am. He didn't do random assignment studies. He didn't do statistics. He didn't collect data, but he did think a lot about human nature. And he thought that we live life in chapters and that each chapter has a goal, and the goals change qualitatively as we move from being, you know, babies to being, you know, old women and men. And as we, you know, finish a chapter, it's because like it's in some ways the goal has been met, and also because like we have a new goal that's like more appropriate for the next phase of life. And the chapter that he would argue, I think the fourth chapter was industry, and like that's like working really hard and like, you know, setting out things to accomplish and then accomplishing them and, you know, becoming more skilled and so forth. That happens maybe in your like early adulthood, maybe the end of your teenage years. But then you kind of like march through to these other ones. And the chapter that I think he would think I'm in, I'd have to check, is like just based on my age, is generativity. Mm-hmm. And that is having accomplished enough to kind of be in a position to do so, to like literally almost look back and then to reach back with your hand and say, like, you know, to the someone who's behind you, like, you know, here, come along, let me give you a hand. And there's a chapter that's after this actually called wisdom, I think. But I don't really understand what that is, but maybe it's because I'm not in that chapter yet. Anyway, I think it's a really intriguing way to think about life as a story of chapters, each with its own goal. And I do think there is a kind of natural progression. And a lot of people my age probably think like, okay, I have enough to eat. I'll always have enough to eat. Like, I have a lot of other of my needs met. Like, you know, what can I do to be helpful?
I love that. I think when the wisdom chapter reminds me of a gentleman called Chip Connolly, who runs a Modern Elder Academy. And he talks about how at that stage it is that either reverse mentoring or, you know, collating the wisdom at that stage in your life to again fuel others to think differently and do differently.
Yeah, that sounds you know, right in line with what I think Erickson was describing.
Yeah. So another kind of point I love to establish with my guests is I help my clients create almost like a happiness compass, a way in which they can kind of structure their day and really think about how they can show up as their, I guess, authentic self in the way that they work, lead, love, and communicate with others. And it's a mixture of the VIA strengths, but also what we call our love it or leave it values. And so to give you an example, mine are zest, wisdom, beauty and excellence, self-regulation, joy, newness, timelessness, and connection. And so I'll pick four as my compass points every day to kind of guide the flow of how I want to work and create a sort of intentionality. How would you say you intentionally start your day and do any of those kind of strengths or values that you walk in action kind of come to mind for you?
Well, I love the metaphor of a compass because for a long time, I would say, you know, one of the things that people who are very accomplished and also very happy have is like a very clear goal. Mm-hmm. And then I would say like, look, I can draw you not only the goal that I have, you know, use psychological science to help kids thrive, but I can draw for you all the sub goals that those, you know, higher level aspirations lead to. And like, looks like this beautiful pyramid and like, look, that's what it means to have a good day, that your little goal down here of what you're going to get done today matches up and advances these higher level goals in this beautiful hierarchy. And for a long time, I thought that was true, but of late, I've begun to think that like, it's not quite right. I think what we really have is a compass so that directionally we have values and maybe interests that we're moving toward, kind of like navigating by the stars, right? Like there's lots of ways to get there. You're going in that direction. The more you go in that direction, the more, you know, you do feel like your authentic self, that you feel fulfilled, but it's not exactly like a, you know, like a piece of paper with a goal on it. And it's like this specific, I think there's a lot more latitude, if you will. So I love that metaphor. Now, do I do this? I haven't done what you are recommending your clients do. It sounds like it could be very helpful and I should try it of being intentional in that day and saying like, you know, what values do I want to live today? You know, when I go to bed, like what will make this a good day? You know, what is my compass for the day? Mm-hmm. So I haven't done that. If I were to do it for just today, because, you know, for me, most of the day spreads before me an unpainted canvas. Like what direction should I go in? I do think I'm trying to, you know, I really am. I said I want to be a giver. I want to be a learner and a doer. I think I'm already like really a doer. So Samantha, I just like my day is just like very execution oriented. And, you know, there's about 2 seconds between meetings and, you know, all these tasks that are lined up. So my whole life is designed to be productive. Okay. I think if I could balance that with having some ability to be in the moment and allow things to sort of, you know, go off track, like, hey, it turns out that like that thing that we were supposed to get done didn't get done because something else needed to happen. Like we need to have a conversation about this other, you know, issue or being even just a little bit more mindful of like when you're a doer and when you're doing a lot of doing, you're not always like doing a lot of experiencing. So, you know, like just tasting your lunch in the 2.5 minutes you've allotted to eat it. Like, you know, in like, what does the sun feel like today? I feel like I could use a little bit of that as a compass to bring me, you know, in a direction that I don't always go myself.
Experiencing. So this kind of leads me to, you know, the basis of your career and thinking about grit. And one of the things that I know about myself is that when I am, I guess, driven towards a goal and feeling alive by it and conscious about, you know, where this is going to take me, I know that there isn't much time for experiencing, or that flies out the window for me. And so how do we navigate the desire to meet our goals and to be steadfast towards something with the experiencing? If you yourself find that difficult, like how do we navigate that? Or is it just something we have to make peace with the fact that sometimes the determination to achieve means that we have to compromise?
Well, I think, Samantha, that there is, first of all, a real tension that you're right about, which is that when you're executing, when you're doing, you know, there is a trade-off, which is that like in that moment, you got your head down, you're like solving problems, like you're not necessarily reflecting, mm-hmm. you're not necessarily experiencing, you're not necessarily absorbing. And sometimes psychologists distinguish between being in locomotor mode, you know, you're doing, mm-hmm. you got a plan and you're like, you know, ticking off the to-do list. And if there's an obstacle, you're figuring out a way around it, et cetera, versus being in a kind of assessment mode, which is reflective. And you're like thinking like, what's good, what's bad, like what's going on here. And they are different modes. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't be both in your life, but it does suggest to me that you kind of can't be both at the exact same moment in time. Mm-hmm. You're either locomoting, you're doing, you're executing, or you're reflecting, you're thinking, you're feeling. And I think then the best thing that I can think of is to have some intentionality about toggling between those modes, mm-hmm. because it's not possibly good to only be in one versus the other. You know, if you're only in this kind of like reflective mode where you're assessing, you know, what's good, what's bad, what's going on, then you really don't get anything done. Mm-hmm. But if you're only doing, then you might not even be going in the right direction, you know, as fast as you're paddling and as much quote unquote progress as you're making. So I think maybe the wisest people, you know, and there are people in my life professionally and personally who I admire for this, like they do seem to have developed a capacity to toggle between mm-hmm. these modes, you know, to like put their head down and really get a lot done, but also to have a really nice dinner and it's like really, and or just as it comes up, right? Like, you know, like to have at least some awareness so that you're like, you know what? Right now, my daughter, you know, really needs to have a conversation with me, and I'm just gonna like drop everything and talk to her. So I do think that there's this toggling that we can get better at. You know, certainly I'm trying to get better at it.
Mm. How would you say that self-control and grit are some of the keys to a better life, or would you say that?
I do, with some, you know, footnotes. So let me begin by saying that, you know, when I became a psychologist, I had been previously a teacher, and I saw how important, you know, time on task was to students of any age, you know, doing well. It's like, you know, you can't just be smart. You have to actually spend time, you know, learning grammar or calculus or anything. So my obsession as a new psychologist was to understand the psychology of effort. And I studied two different ways in which people can sustain effort. One is grit, which mm-hmm. is sustaining effort towards, you know, long-term goals that you are really personally, you know, identified with, you know. And then the other is self-control, like things that you're not necessarily identified with, like flossing, paying your taxes, you know, for some people like exercising, but you really know it's good for you. So it's also effort. It's also goal-directed, but not these like really identity-relevant personal goals that, you know, give direction to your whole life. And I do think to some extent, you know, some amount of grit and certainly some amount of self-control do contribute to a life well-lived. Mm-hmm. I would say that, the footnotes are many, though. Like, it's not the most important thing. You know, when you mention your VIA, you know, strengths, you know, the, you know, maybe the ones that, you know, are especially important and part of your identity, mm-hmm. you know, like there are many of them, you know, like, you know, things that I, for example, are not very high on, like appreciation of beauty, or things that are not the same thing as grit or self-control, like zest. You know, there are other dimensions that I think are like just on principle more important. Like it must be more important to be an honest person mm-hmm. and a kind person than it is to be a gritty person or even mm-hmm. a self-controlled person. So I think one footnote is that when I think of character more broadly, you know, a term you could use other synonyms for character, but like the whole person, I think grit and self-control are facets of that, but not the most important ones, and definitely not the only ones. So that's one big footnote. And I think when you write a book called Grit, it might be easily assumed that you think it's the most important thing in the world, but you know, it's not to me as a mother, you know, mm-hmm. as a human being, as a friend, as a wife, you know, it's not the thing that I think is most important. The second thing is, you know, I think there's something about these words, grit and self-control, and just the idea of individual effort that can be misunderstood as suggesting that, you know, there's no such thing as racism or there's no such thing as poverty or inequality. I actually think there are all of those things and there are objective realities. And I don't want the emphasis on, you know, what we can each individually do to diminish the significance of things that only society can do or that are, you know, to some extent outside an individual's direct control. So I think those are the two big footnotes I would give is that, yeah, I believe in grit and self-control with the caveat that they're not the most important things in life. And with the caveat that it does not imply that, you know, the individual is like all powerful and takes full responsibility for everything that they do and that happens to them.
There's this like independence and interdependence, right? We can go so far, but also there is the ecosystem we operate in, the changes that are happening beyond our control as well.
Yeah, we're deeply interdependent, and only through, you know, blindness and arrogance are we ever so, you know, deluded as to think that like everything we got at this point is because we earned it. I say that as somebody who can easily forget, you know, how, you know, the winds of fortune and many, many hands like have made my life such a comfortable and, you know, easy one, because I could say, well, I worked hard and look at what I did. But also, like, what about all these other people who, you know, nobody even knows about, and maybe I don't even know about, you know, like, you know, and that made my life as it is. You know, the expression in the United States is often like you hit a home run and you forgot that you were born on third base. But I do think it's easy to sort of obsess about our own contributions to our life outcomes. And I know I'm guilty of that, and I'm trying to remediate that.
When you think about strengths, I listened to a podcast that you're on, and you talked about how we need to, or you used a sports phrase about racing your strengths and training your weaknesses. And I guess in this time of conversations between, you know, the individual self and the role that you play within a team, how do you think we should balance out or understand our strengths and our weaknesses in relation to the grit that we pour into our work and the role that we play in teams?
So the idea that you should first, you know, identify your strengths and lean into them, you know, recognize them for what they are and try to match your life to them, I think is, you know, really important and not obvious to people who are used to doing the second thing all the time, which is like choose your weaknesses and try to train them, remediate them. I think when you talk to very successful people, I'm thinking of Kat Cole, who was a Hooters restaurant waitress, and a hostess, even not even a waitress yet, as a teenager, worked her way up to becoming the CEO of a $1 billion food company. She absolutely, you know, went out of her way to remind me of that, because I was talking to somebody about how so much of being an expert is like choosing things you can't yet do and then working on them. She was like, yeah, but don't forget, you have to race your strengths. Let's be specific about it. I guess I'll just speak from my own personal experience, because I know it best. I mean, I love words. I love writing. And I think as a scientist anyway, I'm like above average in my ability to use words and to write. You know, should I ignore that strength, or should I think, hey, this is a superpower in every collaboration? You know, maybe I'll be the one to rewrite the introduction of the article, or, you know, maybe I'll be the one to, you know, try to craft the title. I think leaning into your strengths, identifying your superpowers and saying like, hey, how do I line up my life so that I can use these more? And a superpower doesn't mean that it can't be built, right? So it means like, hey, how could I become a better writer? You know, or like, I really, really enjoy other people. That's a superpower for me. How do I line up my life so that I get to do that more, maybe get paid for it? And how do I get even better at being with people? So I think that part shouldn't be skipped over. And I think for a lot of young, hard hardworking people, certainly the way I was in my 20s. But that's something which they like, they literally don't think about enough. Mm-hmm. And I think the most successful and happiest people are always doing things that they have some inclination toward. Not that they can't be built, but that it like is already a strength for them in some way. Okay, so that's the first part. And when I teach undergraduates, I call this choose easy. And it's like non-intuitive. They're like, what? Choose easy? I thought we were supposed to choose hard things. And I'm like, no, choose easy things. You know, for me, choosing to write is an easy choice. You know, choosing to do hierarchical linear modeling and statistics, it's a harder choice, right? I'm like, I guess I could learn that. I guess I could learn how to program, you know, computer code, but I would much rather like go read a book of poetry. So like maybe I should, you know, use words. The second thing then, having chosen easy, is to then work hard, or you could even say like work smart. But the working on your weaknesses, I do think is important. When I, you know, trained under Marty Seligman, and he said that I wasn't very good at theory, it was very important to me to train that weakness. How do you choose which weaknesses to train? Because I think you could spend your whole life, you know, working on every weakness and then again, not get very far. I think you only should train the weaknesses that are so important to what you've chosen to do, so important to the way you're showing up in the world, that you just have to train them, or you can't, you know, you can't do what you want to do. You know, for me, it wasn't optional. Like you can't be a great psychologist and be very bad at like theory. So I needed to train that. But I think anything that you could outsource, you know, I have a very good friend, my collaborator at the Character Lab, the nonprofit that I, you know, helped create. And his name is Sean, and he's, you know, in charge, and he's great at many things. He hates doing things that are very detail oriented, like, you know, submitting his expenses and, you know, doing that kind of work. And, you know, you could argue that he should train that weakness, like, well, you know, Sean, you can't, but no, he can simply ask somebody else on his team to do the things that they might like to do more and that he might like to do less. So I think you should only train the weaknesses that you can't outsource, and that aren't, you know, part. So that gives you a shorter list, I think, of weaknesses to really train. I mean, the way to think about it is, you know, what can I invest in that would really have the biggest return on that investment? And for him, it's certainly not like getting better at submitting receipts.
So I'd love to take a step backwards then, because a question that I often hear from some of my clients is, I don't really know what my strengths are, or I'm just not sure I'm wholeheartedly good at X. And so there's a doubt that, is this thing a strength, or have I just allowed myself to believe that I can get it done swiftly and I can do it? Is this something that I actually enjoy? Does it energize me? I don't know if they're often asking themselves that question.
So you know, I have a therapist whom I love, whose name is Dee, and she gave me the advice very recently, and I think it's such good advice, that like sometimes when we can't do something, like it's like the very first step is to even just be able to access, you know, like that. So, you know, when somebody says, you know, I don't even know what I'm good at, like, I don't even know what my strengths are, it's not at all an absurd thing to say. It's absolutely possible to not be, you know, aware, or like, you know, to not be able to access like that self-knowledge. And I think there's two things that I would suggest as practical tips of how to begin to access, you know, what you're very good at, and what comes quote unquote naturally. I know it's a little bit dangerous language, because it's like, oh, by naturally, do you mean you can't change it? No, but like there is some inclination there. So the first tip is, you know, I think the phrasing that I've found myself is like, what gives me energy? And what makes me feel tired, right? So if I made two lists, and again, I teach students this, and I actually literally as a homework assignment have them make two lists, and I make them too, because I do all the same homework as my students. One is like, this gives me energy. Mm-hmm. And the other one is like, this makes me feel tired. And when I write down on the energy list, it's like, well, it gives me energy to read articles in psychological science. Like, it gives me energy to read anything because I love language. It gives me energy to talk with my collaborators. What's on the, like, oh, this makes me tired, this depletes my energy list, right? It makes me feel exhausted. Being in really long faculty meetings, also doing things that I wish I liked, but I just don't. Like, I really don't like managing people, like, you know, helping them reach their potential by giving them feedback and coaching them. Probably what you do, Samantha. I'm guessing that that gives you a lot of energy. Mm. I kind of wish I did get energy, but I think if I had to be with clients one-on-one, you know, walking them along their journey, I would actually find that exhausting. I don't know why, but I do. So I think that is one tip, is just to look for energy, you know, like pluses and minuses in your life. It's usually pretty easy to first start with the things that make you feel tired, you know, and like fill up that list and then say like, okay, what's the opposite of that? You stare at that list and you start to realize things that might not have been obvious to you. You start to see patterns, I think, and writing it down, I think, can be especially helpful. So that's one tip. And then the other one is to ask other people what they see. You know, like, we should be able to see ourselves, but of course, so often, for whatever reason, like, it's other people in our lives who can see us more clearly. You know, my husband is around me probably as much as anyone now that my kids are grown up. But my kids and my husband, all of them have been, you know, enormously insightful about what I like and don't like, even though they're not me. You know, like, they would say to me, like, oh, you hate vacation. Like, you must love to work, because I just, you know, my daughters grew up and they were like, yeah, I think our number one image of growing up is like you behind a laptop. You know, it's like, really? Do I? And they're like, yeah. So I think actually also just asking the people who know you best, like, what do you think my superpowers are? And then maybe, you know, what do you think my kryptonite is, right? Like, you know, what are the things that just really seem to sap the life out of me? So those are two ways, I think, to begin to access a little bit, you know, what you lean toward.
So a couple of things spring to mind as you were talking. I love the fact that you said you couldn't really do, you know, my job, or that just feels like your version of hell. But I find it fascinating that, you know, the way that you hold your students and the exercises that you give them and the advice, it kind of feels like the same thing, just on a bigger scale. You're doing it with a group.
But Samantha, isn't that fascinating? You know, there's someone that I studied and I really admire, Roberto Diaz, who is an Emmy award-winning violist, right? So viola is like that instrument that looks like a violin, but it's a little bigger. And my husband played it and my daughter played it for a while. And, you know, as a non-musician, I would look at the viola and the violin and I would say, oh, they're just about the same thing. Just like you were saying, like, oh, therapy and maybe sharing things in the classroom setting, like, kind of the same thing. Yeah, like, one's a violin and the other's a viola. But I think the Roberto Diaz parable will tell us how very important is these, like, small differences are. You know, so he did play violin growing up because his parents were both professional musicians. And he liked it okay, and he was quite good at it, but he didn't like it that much. And, you know, he much preferred to be a professional soccer player. But then he did pick up the viola. Again, just a couple centimeters bigger than a violin, looks exactly the same to a non-musician. And fell in love with it, right? And so, like, why the viola, not the violin? I don't even know that he has a good explanation for it. Why do I like teaching, but I don't like doing therapy? I don't know, Samantha. I don't know. I think the parable teaches us this, is that nobody knows, you know, nobody knows that, like, you know, standing on your feet in a lab with test tubes is going to be a joy for them or hell for them until you try it, because the differences that we're talking about can be quite subtle. Yes. And for whatever reasons that we may never figure out, you know, the fit's not there or it is. And I think then that says we just have to try things. You know, you try out therapy as a therapist and you discover you don't like it so much and you do less of it. You know, you try out teaching, you discover you like it more than you thought and you do more of it, right? You can't really know in advance.
Yes, totally. And I think there are nuances to the way that you're working and I am, that to the untrained eye could look similar, but also equally vastly different as well. But
exactly. And we are that untrained eye before we do it, right? Like, you know, before we try it, you know, we might, I actually thought I was going to be a therapist when I started graduate school. And I thought, I was like, what's therapy? It was literally a box that you checked off on the PhD application. It was a box. It was like, do you want clinical training? And I didn't, I knew so little, Samantha. I literally didn't, I had to ask my advisor at the time, Marty Seligman. I was like, what is this box that says clinical training? Like, what is that? And he was like, oh, don't check it. I was like, don't okay.
Do it. Run. Yeah.
And then I was like, wait, but what is it? And he was like, oh, think of the most boring person. This is literally what he said, Marty Seligman. He was like, think of the most boring person you knew in all 4 years of college. Do you have a mental image of that person? And I was like, I guess I do. And he said, okay, now imagine being locked in a room with them for 40 hours a week. I mean, Marty was being funny. I guess he was being hyperbolic. Maybe this is how he felt about being a therapist. I mean, what's interesting about his story is that he too, you know, was interested in the general idea of helping other people through psychology, which I think draws a lot of people to becoming, you know, well, the sort of person you are. But for whatever reason, Marty did not like to have those one-on-one conversations. And maybe he was giving me a rather exaggerated version of how it felt for him. And then he was imagining that that's how it would feel for me. I ended up not checking that box, Samantha, actually mostly for logistical reasons. Like I didn't have the ability to go on the internship afterwards that was required because I was married to somebody who had a very local job. But I will say from my experience of being in therapy and also just like, you know, like seeing other things that are like close to therapy that I would have to do, like managing people and like talking to them about their, you know, where they are. It's a, I think the part of it that in retrospect, I can say like, yeah, it wasn't a good fit for me was the patience and the care that you really need to be with somebody, you know, as they make their way on the journey. I'm much better at giving like a 45 minute lecture and being like, okay, see you next Tuesday. look forward to getting your essays, you know, so that subtle difference, like who would know? Like you can't know until you, you know, life, you can't know until you try it.
And that's the power as well, just being resolute in that is not for me. And so, you know,
and that's okay.
Yeah, and that's okay too. I'd love to talk a little bit more about your grit scale because I have taken it a few times over my life. And a question that for me is a bit of a sticking point. And so the grit scale is essentially your research tool for self-reflection on how gritty we really are. And so at the moment, I'm scoring an average of 3.75.
Interesting. And higher on perseverance than on passion, I assume?
Yeah, but I found some of your questions quite provocative. And I think over the years, it was higher a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed it dropped and I was like, oh, it's interesting. But then when I was looking at it and thinking about being interested in new pursuits every few months, and I guess the question that I have is, I feel like I'm a very steadfast person. Like when I want something, I will go for it and I will work hard. But at the same time, I can hold multiple other things I like doing that might not be, I might not finish immediately, but they're in the peripheral vision. So I do balance a lot of things and I've always got lots of new ideas. And so how do you balance this person who is a bit maybe multi-potentialite and is driven to multiple goals, but kind of has different attention spans?
Well, okay. So the items on the passion subscale of the grit scale are all about the consistency of your interests over time. And why are they that way? And what does it mean not to score very highly on those items? Well, why they are that way is because when I interview people who are truly world-class at what they do tend to be obsessives. You know, like I'll use Jasper Johns, the contemporary artist, as an example, only because I recently walked through two exhibits that, you know, collectively, you know, gave the like arc of his life work. And he really is obsessive. I mean, he would have like a pattern of, you know, lines that he would see, and then he would just like want to work on it for years, you know, 7 days a week. Like, oh, I wonder these like diagonal lines in opposition, like, you know, and then you see all these different paintings and he does it as a print and he does it as a sketch. And then there's an oil painting and it's a motif that comes up again 20 years later and then 40 years later. You know, there is a kind of consistency in this attention that some people voluntarily give to certain things. You know, they don't think about it for a moment and then go on to something else. Like, it's a preoccupation. It sits before them, which I think is like the origin. If you look at the root etymology of obsession, it's like something that sits before you and you kind of can't get it out of your way. Now, I don't necessarily think that is something that like all people want to have, you know, like if you ask most people like, hey, do you want to get so obsessed with something that like you can't stop thinking about it and it comes back to you and haunts you. And then, you know, in one tiny different way than another, like, you know, you sort of are working on that same puzzle for days, weeks, years, decades, maybe a lifetime. I think a lot of people would be like, why would I ever want that? So first I will say that I don't think that that trait or that characteristic is something that everybody would aspire to. And it certainly doesn't make you a worse person. There's nothing moral or immoral about that, choosing to kind of submit yourself, or maybe it's not even choosing, maybe it's involuntary. The other thing is that's a wrinkle here is, I think when you look at the lifetime, there's research on this, not by me, by the way, but by other scientists, about like very, very successful and creative people. What you find is that there is actually a toggling between a sort of like specialization where they're really like these diagonal lines, like this pattern, there's really something there. And they just really go all in and they, you know, work on it with a kind of ferocity for a long time. But then they toggle into like a sampling mode where they are like, you know, trying out different things, you know, they're kind of tired of that idea, you know, they're tasting all different stuff. And then they get, you know, something that really feels like this is good. And then they go back into specialization. So I think one thing that is not revealed by this very crude questionnaire that I made when I was like a first year graduate student. And even when you look at people like Jasper Johns, you know, like if you look at his career, it's not that he worked on diagonal lines his whole time, right? It was more like there was a period where that was an obsession. Then there was a period where he had another obsession. You know, he had an obsession with mortality. You know, he had an obsession with like iconographic, like, you know, iconograph, like flags. So even in the life of an obsessive, gritty person, you can see that there are epochs, you know, there are periods of sampling, periods of specialization. So I think for most of us, I think the advice would be, you know, it is arguably true that when you want to go farther and deeper than anyone into something, there is a kind of cumulative time on task that you need. At the same time, you know, that's not necessarily what everyone chooses. And even those who do choose that path probably have some amount of like exploration that breaks up this, you know, obsessive single-minded pursuit. And that may be like the most, you know, productive way to be anyway. So that at least licenses you to have, you know, the freedom to like quit things and to try things out in an unserious, flirtatious way.
I totally think that I am the latter, because I think for me, there is something around, you know, my core is helping leaders, individuals really think about well-being and their own self-leadership and how that equates to working with others. But I think I want to look at it in and tackle it from different angles. So yes, I'm doing the coaching right now, and then more of the therapeutic angle, thinking about how we get arts into creative leadership and breaking it down that way. So I think I like the idea of the sampling and then the specializing. I feel like that kind of lets me off the hook a little bit.
And Samantha, you know, you do have something that I think, you know, gives this sampling more of a purpose. And again, it doesn't have to be, you know, strategic and tactical. But when you do have something that you really care about, I mean, my guess is that like, if we had another conversation in 10 years, you would still directionally be interested in helping people, you know, lead themselves and others. And so what form that would take, you know, would it still be exactly this podcast? Would you have done something else? Would it be like, but I do think one thing that gives that sampling period some purpose and some like, you know, like underlying, you know, meaning is that like when I think about my own life, it's like, you know, if I watch a movie like Copenhagen and I'm just watching a movie because I'm like a normal human and I like to watch movies that my friends recommend, you know, I'm at one level just watching a movie and thinking, wow, Daniel Craig really is a perfect human being. Like, oh my gosh. At another level, you know, maybe that day, maybe the next day, I noticed while I at one level just simply wanted to watch a really good film, I was like, wow, like, you know, I want to know more about this story of like, you know, Heisenberg and Bohr and like, wow, now all of a sudden I'm thinking about grit again. And all of a sudden I'm thinking like, you know, what made them so obsessive? And like, you know, how did they like, you know, where did they have siblings? Did they all come out that way? Like what happened next? So I think to some extent we can relax, we can sample, we can certainly have diverse pursuits. When you are somebody who has a purpose in their life, you will find, I think, without even making yourself, like you'll start to draw connections. So I think, you know, in addition to saying that like toggling can be helpful, there is something about the, you know, having a you know, a calling or a purpose that, you know, without you even making it so, you know, will allow you to fertilize, you know, even if you don't end up becoming a filmmaker, like you could bring something into your craft from some other, you know, tangential, it seems, pursuit.
Love that. My last question to you is it possible to be steadfast in a pandemic? Like, what would you say has shifted in your life and your business that you were perhaps very gritty about, in inverted commas, but the pandemic has changed that, reshaped it for better or worse?
You know, the pandemic has been many things, but one that it has been for quite literally, I think, every person on the planet Earth has been, it's been a disruption. So what we know about human nature and human behavior is that a lot of what we do is really automatic. You know, we don't think about it in a very conscious way, like, should I brush my teeth? Should I go to the bathroom? Should I have lunch? You know, like, should I work on my email? Like, it just happens, you know, you just do it. And William James, the great psychologist and philosopher, once said, you know, habit is the great flywheel of society. And it's true that like doing things in a automatic, habitual, not super reflective way can be very efficient. What's happened during the pandemic is the disruption has sort of shaken all of us, jolted us awake, as it were. And we're like, wait, what am I doing? Is this the work I want to be doing? Is this what I want to be eating? Is this the way I want to be talking? Is this the way I want to be relating? Is this the person I want to be married to? Like, you know, what am I doing? You know, and it does feel a little bit like getting like jolted awake from a long slumber. Now, for some people, I think that has resulted in the great resignation, right? Yeah. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, are you kidding? For others, I think it's been an affirmation. Like, I've been jolted awake. I now see what I'm doing and I really want to do it. And I want to do it more. I want to do it better. For me personally, with this disruption, which has been, you know, arguably less than for others, because being a professor isn't that different from living a pandemic lifestyle, to be honest, I have like thought hard, like, you know, life is short and it will not last forever. No matter how healthy you eat or how much you exercise, like it will come to, you can't cheat death. And I certainly won't be the person to do that for the first time. And for me, it's been more of an affirmation, you know, instead of saying like, wow, I realize that the clock is running out and I don't want to be a professor. I don't want to be a psychologist. I don't want to write, you know, I don't want to be working on all these papers. For me, it's been a kind of, you know, affirmation of what I really do want to do. And so I've been very fortunate that way. But I certainly think whether you come out of this as somebody who wants to do what they've been doing less, or you come out as somebody who wants to do it more with kind of a renewed clarity. It is, as painful as it is and as unbidden as it is, I think it is really growth. You know, I mean, I don't know how many people could say that if they're being honest in the last 2 years, like that they didn't grow more in those 2 years in terms of self-understanding. And that's certainly been the case for me.
Yeah, there has definitely been a lot of growth and shape shifting for me as well. But I think I feel better for it. Thank you so much for your time. I could speak to you for ages, but I'm aware that we have come to the end of our time together. Where can people find out a bit more about you and the work that you're doing at the Character Lab as well?
So Samantha, I've really loved our conversation. And the first and best place, I think, is this nonprofit called characterlab.org. Because not only me, but lots of other scientists like Adam Grant and Ethan Cross and Bill Damon, the experts in whatever it is that Aristotle said is to live the life well lived. We gather there and we try to provide actionable advice based on the latest psychological science. So it's characterlab.org. And also I'm on Twitter and other social media platforms. I'm not a hugely productive tweeter, but you can find me there too.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Samantha. I've loved our conversation. I hope it's not the last one.
Hello, hello. Well, what another fantastic episode. Thank you so much for carving out the time to hang out with us and hear everything that was shared today on our podcast. If you are interested in becoming a changemaker and something has piqued your interest and you want to either revamp your own ways of looking at your well-being as you lead a team through change, or maybe you want to create deeper interventions in your company that are going to stick and that people care about actually using, why not join our Changemaker certification? This is our roadmap to helping you go through our three areas of change: becoming a better change maker, empowering and inspiring others to do the same, and amplifying the message that you have created. Check out all the details of our Changemaker certification on loveitleaveit.co, and I cannot wait to get started with you. See you soon for another amazing episode. Bye for now.